This particular talk is on Emiliano Zapata and the Mexican Revolution. We should be having translation. Is the person here? Is there a person here who will be translating? Hay un miembro aquí que va a dar la traducción. No, Does anybody need translation?
Sí, claro.
Todos.
Yeah. All right, estamos bien. Okay, estamos bien. Okay.
Por favor, a mi idioma.
¿En serio? ¿Necesita traducción?
No, no. Oh. Mi idioma.
All right. Okay. Okay, so we have Victor Fresi who will be giving the presentation. So without further ado, I'm going to give it up to Victor.
Welcome everyone from LA. So one of the things I'm probably going to talk about, I'm going to talk about the Mexican Revolution through the experience of Zapatistas. So I'm not going to talk about a lot of things pertaining to the entire Mexican Revolution, but I will talk a little bit of an overview of this revolution, but more importantly, on some of the things and lessons that we could learn from the Zapatista experience. So the Mexican Revolution was one of the first revolutions in the 20th century, and one of the most important ones in the Americas. It saw the rise of a self-conscious peasant masses who organized very powerful armies under Zapata and Villa and were able to really shape the political landscape of this revolution. Even though in the end, the sort of petty bourgeois elements won the day and created the modern-day Mexican capitalism that we know, it is important to take some of these lessons, and especially for revolutionaries, of what the Zapatista experience shows us. And one thing to keep in mind, and I think for anybody that's ever been to Mexico, is that Mexico can't really Mexico is not like the United States, which it can control all of its territory. It's had a huge history of peasant and indigenous rebellions that exist till this day with Zapatistas, a group called the EPR, and you know, just the history of it, it's actually a lot of peasant and indigenous rebellions and a lot of repressions. The one question that I think we want to get at here is like, what's the difference between them that were isolated and crushed as opposed to the Zapatista rebellion, which was able to take Mexico City along with Francisco Villa for a time and bring the capitalist system to its knees. And I will also talk about some of those limitations as well as, you know, why this revolution could not, say, become a socialist revolution. And I will also talk about, you know, some of the different views that Zapata had about creating a different society and how that really threatened the ruling class in Mexico, who really didn't like the fact that normal everyday people, in this case peasants, could actually fight back under their own leadership. And have a way to start ruling themselves, which is actually what happened with the Zapatistas in the south of Mexico, in a state called Morelos, where they were from. In order to talk a little bit about that, I'm going to give a little background to what was going on in Mexico right before the revolution. Mexico, when it during the war its war of independence, and about 50 years afterwards, was in total turmoil. There was like 50 different revolutions, different presidencies. It was a very politically unstable country. All of that was changed during the Porfirio Diaz regime through mass repression and a dictator that was what then allowed Mexico to be stable enough to have capitalist development. And this set the stage for a huge accumulation of capital. And let me just to give you an example of what was going on at the time. And this was during around 30 years or so from like the 1870s to the 1910s, right before the revolution. So in 1880, Mexico had about 1,000 kilometers of railway. By 1910, it had 19,000 kilometers. Most of it was railway that tied into the U.S. railway system, which meant a lot of goods were meant for export. Around the same time, from 1876 to 1911, mine profit rates shot up 200%. Machinery imports grew by about 170% between 1888 and 1910. Between 1877 and 1910, the per capita exports tripled and imports quadrupled. Massive growth in industry and agriculture. But a lot of this, like the modern-day neoliberalism, which we've been living on, was based on foreign investment and benefit to a small group of wealthy industrialists and landowners in Mexico, as well as wealthy investors from predominantly the United States, which caused a lot of friction that I will talk about later. So, for example, by 1911, foreign investors owned most of the 80 largest commercial and industrial establishments. 21 were owned by the U.S., 23 by British, and only 6 were actually owned by Mexican companies. The rest were, you know, split among French, German, Spanish, Canadian. The U.S. was a big player in this. In 1891, they had $200 million worth of investments in Mexico. 14 years later, that figure would quadruple. 80% of the mining investment was from the U.S. And this was also reflected in a lot of the land accumulation. Just to give an example, in the 1910 census by the Diaz regime, Mexico had a population of around 50 million or so people, and for about 1.9 million square kilometers. Most of these people were, 80% were living in villages fewer than 5,000 inhabitants, and, you know, of the economically active population that could work, around 5 million, around, you know, 68% of that was peasants, worked in agriculture and fishing and stuff like that. Majority of the country was a peasant country. And the census also recorded 834 hacendados, which were basically plantation owners. And they owned about, say or so, 167,968,814 acres of land between 834 people. This is a situation in the Porfiriato where you had people owning entire states. Mm-hmm. Like a state. You know, like, I own this state. Sickening. While at the same time, people were being deprived of their lands. Adolfo Gili, in his book, The Mexican Revolution, a really good book that I suggest, sort of puts this into perspective about how this led into what we would know as the Mexican Revolution. So, the history of Porfiria in Mexico revolves around the adjustment and headlong development in national capitalism in the conditions of world capitalist expansion, and hence around the accumulation of contradictions that brought the Mexican social formation to the outbreak of revolution in 1910. In more abstract terms, it is the history of a long period of dynamic equilibrium separating two revolutions, the reform that stabilized the Mexican system, which laid the basis for its existence, growth, and expansion, and the Mexican Revolution, engendered by the crisis in which the inherent contradictions of the process sought resolution. So what ended up happening, there was this huge capitalist accumulation, and a lot of different classes in society were affected very differently, that led them to an actual fight back in 1910. So I'll go through different classes and, you know, mostly focus on the peasantry, because that's where Zapata actually came from, and the land question, which was a huge deal in the Mexican Revolution. There was a pretty strong section of the landowning and industrial elite, which sort of, this is where some of the first people that fought back came about. And, you know, during the Diaz regime, a lot of subsidies, a lot of benefits and support from the government went to a small clique, about 12 families around the Diaz regime. Most of them were foreign. So there was a section within this, you know, this elite that on one side benefited from the revolution, but at the same time did not receive the same support and some of like the same benefits that this small group. So they had a bone to pick with the Diaz regime. Their sort of social advancement was being, you know, stopped by the Diaz regime. This was also true for growing petty bourgeoisie in the cities that, you know, didn't like the fact that they were growing under a dictatorship and longed for democratic rights and certain civil reforms that would open up their advancement as well. This actually formed a big layer within the military, which would be represented by people like Álvaro Obregón. The people who represented the elite were leaders of the revolution, who one of them was, his name was Venustiano Carranza, and the other one was Francisco Madero, who I will talk about in a little bit. This industrial development also created a vibrant working class, and even though there was huge repression during the Diaz regime, you're talking about peasant rebellions being drowned in blood, people being chained up and being sent to plantations in the Yucatan, where I'm from, to die, to be worked to death, and any type of organization, workers' organization, was equally crushed. Even then, there were about, recorded between that period, about 250 strikes, 75 of them which were in the textile industry. Cockcroft, in his book on Mexico's Hope, puts the size of the working class, by 1900, about 8-5% of the adult labor force, or about 107,000 mine and 624,000 manufacturing workers. The most important of their struggles came right before the revolution in two big strikes known as the Cananea copper mining strike. And the Rio Blanco textile strike. So the importance of this, which, you know, put forward give me timer. One of the most important sort of demands of workers, especially in the Cananea strike, was something called equal pay for equal work for both native and U.S. workers. Many of these companies were owned by U.S. interests, and they were bringing U.S. employees that would get paid better than Mexican employees for the same work. You know, it's kind of like here, undocumented people get paid less. It's like the reverse of Mexico. It's your country, and you're getting paid less. That was sort of a big thing. The Cananea strike and the Rio Blanco strike were crushed violently. You know, they ended up with big fights against federal troops. What really pissed off a lot of people with the Cananea strike, which was in a border region, was that Diaz actually allowed the Arizona Rangers to come in and crush that strike.
Wow.
So, you know, a lot of these sort of, you know, very nationalist tendencies, both with workers and the ruling elite who wanted to control their own country, were being engendered by this. Just a little bit about, I won't talk about the Flores Magón stuff, but during this time and right before the revolution, there was this Partido Liberal Mexicano, the Mexican Liberal Party that got created, that actually led some of these important strikes. And they were led by this guy called Ricardo Flores Magón, an anarchist, and his brothers. Initially, the party started out as a very liberal party that put forward reforms of land reform and workers' rights. And what ended up happening is the Magón brothers decided that, you know, to break away from that and go into insurrectionary anarchism. They were exiled to the U.S. and actually started, they were trying to start an insurrection in the north of Mexico, which was easily isolated. But a lot of these sort of point to, like, some of the struggles that were happening right before the revolution. The final sector of, The final sector of society was the peasantry, and this is where I'm going to focus more, because this is what created the grounds of the Zapatismo and the rise of them. Most of the peasants in Mexico were either lived in what was known as agrarian communities, little villages, and I will explain this a little bit more. The haciendas, which were basically plantations, think of the South, but a bit different, and I will talk a little bit more about that. Or they were day laborers that would go from region to region trying to find work, or lived especially in Morelos, a state south of central Mexico, Mexico City, where Zapata was from, where there was huge sugar mills, so they would work in the sugar mill, this sector of the agricultural proletariat. So I will talk about the two methods in which they lived, the haciendas and the agrarian communities, and how, you know, the growth of one came into contradiction with the other, and, you know, the background of a little bit of them. So for anybody that's ever been in Mexico, I don't know if you've ever visited an hacienda. These are plantations. Where I'm from, the state of Yucatan was basically one giant hacienda. if you ever go, it'll be cool. I could show you a lot of things there. My family used to work in them. So the hacienda was actually a relic of pre-capitalist Mexico. It was a unit of production. What it was a sort of self-sustaining agricultural method, which is a plantation that was used for the internal market during the days of the colonial past. When what they would do is they would, you know, create food to feed the mines and everything, so they take silver and extract all these goods from Mexico and send them to Spain. During the Porfiriato, they actually changed, and rather than becoming sort of just being able to produce food for the internal market, with Mexico being open to the world market, they became the center of agricultural production for not only the home market, but mostly for export into the world. And therefore, they expanded rapidly. As a result of expanding rapidly, they needed to acquire the lands surrounding them, and for two reasons. One, to get more farmland to increase their production. And this is what happened in Yucatan. Our the main cash crop was binder's twine, also known as Manila rope, and, you know, in order to grow so much, they had to go and take the land from the peasants and use it for agricultural production. The other reason to take land from peasants was to create an exploitable labor source of land as peasants. If they can't grow their own food, they're going to have to work with you, and that's in essence one of the reasons why they were able to own entire states. And a lot of the things that really pissed off a lot of peasants was that they would take all this land and they wouldn't grow anything on it. They would lay fallow. because it wasn't mainly to produce it, but just to keep the peasants out of it. I think Marx talks about that, you know, and when he talks about the way peasants were, their land was taken away in Britain. The hacienda is very interesting because it wasn't like the plantations in the south in which they employed slave labor. It was actually wage labor. But one of the things that was characteristic of this wage labor was that they would pay people less than what they needed to survive. And then if people wanted to buy anything, they would buy it at a company store, which would create people in an eternal state of debt. And that debt was inherited. So in other words, if you died, your sons would inherit that debt and have to work in the hacienda. The hacendado, which you know was the big person in the hacienda, had complete control. They had jails. they would have their own judicial system. And if you ran away from it, there was a Mexican state that would bring you back. Complete control of people. These haciendas and their growth came into contradiction with the rural community, and this is where Zapata is from. These were small villages that actually, they can get traced from Mexico's pre-Columbian past. This was even before the Spanish came. And what they were basically, they were small agriculture villages that had a surrounding communal land that was controlled by the village themselves, and they employed some form of subsistence farming. And the day-to-day life of it was decided on a localized level. These villages actually still exist in Mexico, and there are autonomous villages in all over Oaxaca and Chiapas and all of that that still follow this type of method. What would happen is that whenever sort of an empire would come in, whether it be a pre-colonial empire like the Aztecs or like the Spanish, rather than rearranging these villages in many occasions, what they would do is they just place themselves at the leadership of it and extract tribute. So this way of life was actually continued throughout all the centuries in Mexican society, used by different aspects. The problem with it is that you know these people took up communal land that the capitalist system needed to take over, and that's where there was a lot of friction. And there was a lot of fight back along these villages. Many of these villages would defend it either through the force of arms, and a lot of them had deeds that were given to them by the rice royalty. And they would keep these documents in there, so whenever you know an hacendado would try to come in, they would go to the Mexican government, and these were honored by the Mexican government. In fact, the position of keeping the documents in this village was a very important elected position. And in Anenecuilco, right before the revolution, a 30-year-old peasant named Emiliano Zapata was elected to this position. And this is where we have the rise of Zapata. Now I'm going to go through a very brief history of the Mexican Revolution. So, you know, the Mexican Revolution was started by sections of the... it was started by Francisco Madero. Diaz did not see re-election in 1910. A lot of people were pissed off at him. And this liberal named Francisco Madero from a wealthy landowning industrialist family decided to challenge him on that. And the ensuing games that Diaz played, which... You know, he had a successor, and then the successor backed down, and then he said, you know, I'm going to run. And then he had Madero arrested and said that the election, he won. You know, eventually Madero escaped to the U.S. and called for Diaz's overthrow. And different sections within society self-organized to overthrow Diaz. This included Zapata, along with various peasant leaders in the south. Francisco Villa, another peasant leader in the north, other wealthy landowners such as Carranza and Álvaro Obregón, who I talked a little bit earlier, and you know they for their varying interests came under Madero. And one of the reasons Zapata actually came under Madero, which was a very intelligent move, was that he promised some form of land reform, and he actually allied with Madero. And you know because Madero was the main leader of this upsurge, was able to use that to unite different villages in the south of Mexico under the banner of land reform. Once Madero took power, he turned around and then asked Zapata to disarm. And, you know, Zapata's like, no. we want our land. And, you know, Madero's like, I'll promise you land if you disarm. And he's like, no, we want it now, and we're going to defend it with our force of arms. When those talks broke down, Zapata broke from Madero and created what was known as the Plan de Ayala, which is basically a very concrete plan, on one side denouncing Madero, on the other side, putting forward a concrete way of land reform, which actually said the peasants are going to take land reform, they're going to defend it through their force of arms, and initially they said we're going to take, you know, we're going to take 2/3 of the land from the haciendas that were initially stolen from us. It's our land, and you know, leave them with something. Eventually, that turned into, you know, we take everything and we don't pay you back, which it's our land anyway. There was a counter revolution. And, you know, this was led by somebody, Felix Diaz, who was affiliated with Diaz, Porfirio Diaz, and a disaffected general known Huerta with the help of the U.S. government. The overthrow of Madero actually allowed all these different forces to reunite again to re-overthrow Huerta. And once that actually happened, you know, all these forces were victorious. Venustiano Carranza, the wealthy landowner, who had then created the Constitutionalist Army, which Villa was a part of, and all the forces in the north were a part of, while Zapata was in the south, had won, and he marched into Mexico City. There was a problem then, and that's what happens with many of these type of different, you know, unions between different classes, then their different interests start to, come into a contradiction. Carranza had no interest in any land reform. He had no interest in any type of reforms. He just wanted to take power and sort of continue what was going on in the Diaz regime. However, the power was in the peasant armies of Villa and Zapata. Villa had a very powerful army that was looked towards, and Zapata literally controlled the south. Had kicked out all the landowners. And one of the interesting things, unlike many of the liberal sort of reformers that say, get me into power and I'll give you land reform, they would go into a village and immediately all the land is yours and sort of start creating their own land reform on the way in the image of what was put forward in the Ayala Plan. So there were already divisions within Villa, the peasant leader, and Carranza. And so Carranza had no interest in negotiating with the left, and it was actually Álvaro Obregón, his main general, who was more of a moderate, that said, you know, they have the power, you have to deal with them, and you have to make some concessions, and you have to talk to them. So they were able to create what was called this Aguas Calientes Conference by 1914, 4 years into the Mexican Revolution. And it was basically a way in which Carranza tried to say, okay, I'm in power, we're going to talk about this, and I'm going to stay in power. It was a way in which Álvaro Obregón looked into it and said, this is where all the people in the Mexican Revolution are going to come. It's a way for me to isolate Carranza on one side, but also try to isolate Villa and Zapata, who were, you know, of the left of the revolution, and sort of take the middle ground and sort of put myself in there as a mediator. All of that backfired. And what ended up happening was both the peasant armies of Villa and Zapata were able to unite. Adolfo Gili talks really good about how that happened. And for anybody that's ever been in political conferences and stuff, when, you know, sections of the left come in and totally shifted leftward, this is exactly what happened. So the arrival of the Zapatistas produced at a political level what Carranza and above all Obregón had been concerned to avert only at a military level, namely the junction for Zapatismo and Villismo. So decisive was the development that it immediately dragged along the whole convention, including the Carrancista delegates, left with neither a program nor coherent arguments with which to oppose it. On October 28th, the Carrancistas, whose radical wing had suddenly found a new lever of support, were forced to join the Villistas in an unanimous acclamation of Articles 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 of the Ayala Plan, all those containing political and social demands, including Articles 12 and 13 as well. The session ended with with cries of "Long live the revolution! Long live the Ayala Plan!" What ended up happening is there was a split in the convention, and the more, you know, right-wing sections, known as the Constitutionalists under Carranza and Obregón, were kind of kicked out of the convention. And a new government called the Conventionist Army and the government sort of took power and allowed Villa and Zapata to take over Mexico City. And this was the highest point in the revolution, when both Villa and Zapata, both peasant leaders, they weren't, you know, intelligentsia or anything, were able to take over all of Mexico and push many of the landowners and some of the more right-wing sections all the way to, you know, a port city known as Veracruz. This was a time when they could actually take power and redirect on a national program you know, and you know, either a new constitution or a new way forward for Mexico, and totally be able to crush, you know, the landowning elite in Mexico. However, you know, there were a couple of problems that showed the political limitations of the peasant armies at this point. On one side, they didn't go and crush Carranza and Álvaro Obregón. But on the other side, they were very hesitant to actually take on power, because in a way, they didn't understand what to do with it. And they didn't have a way to put forward a national coherent program. And what they actually did, both Villa and Carranza said, we've allied with some of these radical sections, they were radical liberal sections of the Carranza regime, we'll let them sort of deal with it. And they didn't want to put forward a radical you know, restructuring of society. They actually looked more towards a liberal type of way of organizing, a very legislative that would keep, they would, you know, give reforms and all of that. But they were more actually afraid of Villa and Zapata than they were afraid of Carranza and Obregón. So what ended up was happening is there was a lot of sort of, for the several months that they took over the city, there was stagnation. You know, these people didn't want to do anything, and Villa and Zapata were there and they had the power, but they didn't have a way forward. And this sort of can be, I mean, the way you can picture it was in a conversation that Villa and Zapata had about this exact point. Villa goes, I don't want public positions because I don't know how to deal with them. We'll see what these people are up to doing. We'll just appoint the ones who aren't going to make trouble. Zapata, I'll advise all of our friends to be very careful, otherwise they'll get the chop. Because I don't think we'll be fooled. It's been enough for us to rein them in, keeping them a close watch on them and keep feeding them under our control. Villa then goes, it's very clear to me that we ignorant men make the war and the cultured people have to make use of it, but they should not give us any trouble. Zapata goes, the men who've worked the most have the least chance of to enjoy those city sidewalks, nothing but sidewalks. As for each time that I walk over these sidewalks, I feel like I'm tumbling down. Villa then comes back and says, this ranch is too big for us. It's better out there. He was meaning Mexico City. It's better out there. As soon as this business is sorted out, I'll be off north to the country. I've got a lot to do up there, and the people up there will fight hard. I mean, such an alliance, I mean, led to stagnation, and because it didn't crush the sort of, you know, ruling elite that were almost defeated in Veracruz, they gave them the time to not only mount a military comeback, but also a political comeback. And this is when Obregón was able to convince Carranza to open up to the left and come up with a plan that would bring in sections of the peasantry and the working class under the leadership of Carranza, the landowners and everything. This was known as the Guadalupe Plan. And being able to militarily regroup, they were able to take back Mexico City. And thus, having done that, they were able to split Villa in the north and Zapata in the south. Then they went on using the Guadalupe Plan, as well as giving concessions to the vast majority of the working class in Mexico City. Under the working class in Mexico City was organized into this group called Casa del Obrero Mexicano, the House of the Mexican Worker. And they then, what they did in there is they gave them concessions. They even gave them the Jockey Club, this nice club that used to be as their headquarters. And even in the strikes they were having, they would mediate on the side of the strikers just to be able to co-opt them into their movement and be able to use them against the peasant armies. They inherently split the working and peasant classes in Mexico. This is not to say that they did it very easily. There were arguments, very hard arguments inside the Casa del Obrero Mexicano about this, but eventually the section that said we'll have to work with them because they're promising us that, you know, under the Diaz regime, they weren't able to organize, and they promised them free reign to organize and do whatever they want and support from the Mexican government. And that side ended up winning out. What ended up happening is the constitutionalist wing under Carranza and Álvaro were then able to, you know, get the workers to organize red battalions, which they used to crush the Villistas in the north and used to crush the Zapatistas in the south. After that, they then crushed the Casa Obrero de Mexicano. And so, obviously a huge mistake in the revolution. and thus, I mean, what ended up then happening is that Carranza put himself into power, and because he didn't, in order to sort of seal his power And in order, and because of the push from his more radical section in his wing, had to put together a convention to create a new constitution. And while most of sort of the more liberal constitutions that we see don't guarantee any social type of reforms, it's very interesting how the radical section in Carranza, influenced by Zapatismo and Villismo, actually pushed that this convention put a constitution that guaranteed workers' rights, that guaranteed women's rights, that guaranteed peasants' rights, that guaranteed subsoil rights for the Mexican population, guaranteed free education. This is actually the most progressive constitution at that time. Well, the U.S. Constitution only says you have a right to be happy. This constitution says you have a right to, you know, to education, you have a right to communal land. And Carranza and the Rurrencas had no interest in actually carrying this through. And in fact, it was until the 40s where most of these were carried through. But Álvaro Obregón was able to use that to sort of organize still disaffected sections with Carranza to overthrow him, install himself in power, grab power, and then sort of, you know, the rest is history. So just to end it, and, you know, what are some of the lessons that I think the Zapatista experience in the Mexican Revolution? I think one of the lessons was the importance of Zapata being very strategic and very political and allying with Madero on one side when it helped broaden out his movement from just being an isolated in a state to actually taking all of the south of Mexico, because, you know, Madero promised land reform. So he then became the point person for Madero in the south of Mexico and went all over Mexico saying, he's promising land reform, let's fight back. And I was able to create a broader movement that tied it to a broader revolution. The importance of the Plan Ayala as giving a concrete form to land reform that was used as a political direction to this movement, but also a way to ideologically shift the rest of the revolution and even split some of the Carrancistas over to the side of, you know, more radical reforms. Zapata was actually, of peasants, he was one of the most, he was actually influenced by very radical socialist and anarchist ideas of the time that were brought into Mexico around the 1850s. The Tierra y Libertad thing was actually came into the 1850s through Greek immigrants who then started schools of rebellion and stuff and helped a lot of the peasant rebellions. And so Zapata was part of the left current, and, you know, this points to the importance of radical ideas, especially during a time of revolution, in influencing some of the major leaders and some of the people in the armies. Finally, I think it talks about that, you know, the strength, especially in a peasant country like Mexico, of peasant-led armies under the banner of land reform, but it also, and their ability to bring capitalism to the knees, but they also lacked, you know, they also lacked an alternative to sort of the liberal calls for democratic and social reforms, and a sort of radical alternative that not only took into account peasants, but workers and various other sections of society that were oppressed. And this has always sort of been a weakness of peasant movements throughout history. Nigel Harris, writing on that, talks and actually gives an overview of this sort of trajectory of the Zapatista rebellion. And he basically, I'll quote him, you know, I'm going to quote a paragraph from him exactly. And, you know, the sporadic riot of peasants in densely populated agricultural areas has more possibilities, which is what was going on in Morelos at the time. Here, rural Luddites directly attack the symbols of immediate oppression, the merchant hoarding grain, the big farmer cutting his labor force or the wages he pays, the state reducing the price it regulates for wine. If such riots are a response to a more general condition of the land reform before the revolution, the riot may spread. And if it coincides with movements in the towns, what was going on with Madero and the revolution, it may provide a contributory element in a movement for radical change. But it is only one tributary to that river. Alone, it can do very little. When Wat Tyler's rebels took London, as when Zapata's warriors reached Mexico City, they did not know what to do with it. Finally, they could only retire back to the world they knew. You know, this ranch is too big for me. I'm going back to my ranch. You know, to the villages and dispersed landholdings. They left the real power of the ruling class, chastened perhaps, but not destroyed. Of course, if the status quo was already under threat from other sources, there was still a revolution going on. And the possibility may exist for a temporary enclave of present power, but once the wider issue is settled and moderated, the national ruling class can react with a force capable in destroying this enclave. And this is actually what happened. Meanwhile, the constitutionalists under Carranza and Obregón were busy attacking Villa. They left Zapata alone for like 4 years in Morelos, and he created what was known as the Morelos Commune. They pretty much allowed the villages to rule themselves, and what helped centralize this was the Zapatista army. He worked as a centralized force in conjunction with the local leaderships to rule their own selves. You know, the landowners were gone. Yeah, all the police and all of that were gone, and they created a sort of way for peasants to rule themselves. Not everything was peachy. There were tensions even with the Zapatista army and local authorities. Yet this was the first time in Mexico that peasants themselves were able to rule over their own lands and collectively benefit from the fruits of their own labor. All of this, of course, was only possible with the presence of armed Zapatistas. And when the constitutionalists, were done with Villa, and they turned themselves on the Zapatistas, they ended up murdering Zapata, and in a prolonged and bloody civil war, were able to crush the Morelos Commune. But this was some of the lessons. Thus, Marx talks about some of these type of things, and the role of peasants in revolutions, and it's an important part of the revolution, but also as a class that by itself cannot put forward a certain different view of society for everyone. What he says is, and this is actually Nigel Harris talking back about the Zapatistas, thus the peasant revolt needs the intervention of parts of other national classes to take it beyond the prescribed role. It is not accidental that the peasantry has always been more oppressed than any other class, has a history of revolt, and yet has so few successes. Success comes when other ambitions are allied to the peasant grievances. This does not mean that peasants will not play an important role in the battle for socialism, but that the role is only possible under leadership from other forces. And what socialists would say is from the proletariat. Without that leadership, the peasant struggle leads to other things. Of course, like Lenin, we must support the peasant movement to the end, but we must remember that it is a movement of another class, not the one that can and will accomplish socialism. This, of course, is not to underwrite the importance of Zapata and his peasant rebellions, but to understand both the strengths of his movement and their limitations in the Mexican Revolution. This revolution, is important to note, happened before the Bolshevik Revolution and the lessons that were gained from that revolution. It also, the height of it happened in 1914 when the international socialist movement was in a state of crisis, the SPD voting for war credits and stuff like that. The working class in Mexico, while well-organized and proven to be militant, eventually sided with the constitutionalists after lengthy debates. It did not remain an independent entity with a specific revolutionary plan. Thus, choosing not to be led by the liberal bourgeoisie, the Zapatistas did the only thing that remained to them when they were in Mexico City, and that was to return to Morelos and defend some of the gains they had gained. In the end, and perhaps the most important reason why the new ruling class in Mexico had to assassinate both Villa and Zapata was because of what they stood for. They stood for the hope of millions of landless and impoverished peasants who hoped for justice in this world from the rich landowners who stole their land. They also stood for the fact that if they were ever going to win this justice, they were going to have to fight for it and be led by one of their own. These are the things that drove fear into the hearts of the Mexican ruling class throughout the Mexican Revolution. These are the things that socialists like us would stand for, and that's why Zapata stands as such an important figure in revolutionary history. So.
Thank you, Victor, for that very thorough and lively presentation. We have about 45 minutes of discussion, so please raise your hand, and I'll keep the list. I encourage throwing out questions so we can get at a more thorough discussion as soon as possible at the beginning, so we don't leave the questions towards the end. So I'll just go ahead and call on you. Let's go ahead and begin the discussion.
In your discussion of the Mexican Revolution, you mentioned the Magón brothers. And today, in the social movements that are active in Mexico, they seem to be very influential. Their thoughts, and would you care to talk about that?
I could talk about that maybe.
Okay. The person in the black shirt.
So you talked a little bit about somewhere in the forum that resulted from the revolution, but can you explain a little bit more whether, you know, how much of it stayed in place, maybe? And whether, I wonder if the ejido system that's in place, is that from the revolution or from before, and how important is that in Mexican culture?
And as the person I call on is speaking, go ahead and raise your hand. Like I said, I'll keep a list. You are very welcome to try to answer these questions as well. After a couple of contributions, I'll go back to the speaker. I won't wait till the very end so he can come in and try to flesh out some of these points. Yes, personal words.
I'm just curious if anybody can see any sort of parallels here, because we don't have a peasant class, we don't have any revolutionary class. Where could such a thing begin?
Well, I'll just say something about the parallels. At least I don't know anything about it. I came here because I didn't know anything about this. Russian Revolution, German Revolution, but U.S. imperialism, but I don't actually know a lot about the history of Latin American struggle, maybe a little bit more about Colombia. What really struck me about this that I heard in this was Zapata's work around that Madero, with that in relationship to the Madero fellow. I mean, I was thinking about Obama, you know, like saying all these great things and that you want to take advantage of, you want to use those sorts of things. But the thing I hear Zapata doing, which I think is brilliant, is saying, yeah, like, great, give us, but being completely independent. Like, basically saying, I'm not trusting you for a second, but in a very friendly way, it seems like. You know, he's like, oh, of course, you want us to have independence. Of course, we'll stay armed and we'll take this land because this is what you want us to do. You know, I could imagine, I mean, we could have a workers' movement in this country right now if it took Obama at some of the words that he did during his election. There'd be sit-ins, not just in Chicago, there'd be sit-ins at schools right now, under the banner of Obama, you know, like saying, I'm just doing what Obama told me. Fight for a movement that's gonna, I mean, that was really brilliant to me. And the other thing that just struck me, in some ways it's surprising, because you hear about other revolutions, like I think about the Chinese Revolution, which is a little bit more peasant-led, but there's a kind of honesty between Zapata and Villa about their situation, which is like, we don't really know how to run the state. Which, I mean, it's kind of surprisingly, in other situations, parties have stayed in power and kind of been brutal doing that, ultimately, because they're kind of stuck in the same bind, but they don't realize that they don't go back, you know? And, I mean, I don't... That's just some of the stuff that was really striking. I kind of wonder, what's that experience that led to them being such... insightful but honest figures about that kind of stuff.
And also, please introduce yourself and tell us where you're coming from, where you're from. Josh.
Hi, my name is Josh. I'm in the mission branch of the ISO, which means here. And I too didn't know much about this at all, and just feel like I know like 10 times as much as when I came into the room. But did some reading on this before to try and prepare for this meeting. And one of the things that I found really quite shocking reading this is that usually when you go back and read in hindsight about revolutions, you think, oh, I would have done that differently, or I would have done this differently. But I'd be interested to hear, Victor, what you think, you know, what things we could learn and say, oh, that would have been great if they had done this differently. The thing that struck me is that, unlike Russia, the working class, although that, you know, you're saying it was sort of forming things, it really wasn't as powerful as it was in Russia, even though, you know, it was not particularly strong in Russia, you know, relative to the rest of Europe, and it definitely wasn't as politically developed. I also agree with what Andy was saying about the humility and the wisdom of Zapata and Villa to recognize their position. But the stuff I read that Harris article, and the thing that came out for me in that was, he very clearly explained in a sort of a non-judgmental way about the limitations of peasantry, and I think that you know, I think that it's easy for it to come, you know, to sort of look back at history and say, well, you know, peasants can only go so far and things, but it's actually a really frustrating thing when you look at it, and it's not because of any limitations on their part as individuals or people. It's the material conditions they live in, and then the aspirations that come out of that. So they, you know, they didn't have experience in controlling cities and running the means of production in the big cities. They had experience in working the fields and their aspirations would control that, which didn't necessarily lead to, you know, wanting mass sort of centralized control over everything. No, that doesn't work out from that consciousness. So, I think that looking back to it, the only thing I kept on thinking is like, what was happening with the U.S. working class relating to this, and how did that? Because it seems like, you know, much like we look to people in Palestine today, and the limitations of power they have. You know, we look to the Arab working class. I wonder, you know, when we think about permanent revolution and things, what was the response of the American working class to the revolution at the time? And, you know.
Hey, I have Kathleen here, and then after Kathleen, you, Ms. Kosher.
Okay, hi, I'm Kathleen. Just to give a sense of Mexico, here it's after the Spanish-American War, where, you know, Mexico has lost half of its territory to the United States. So you've got foreign capital owning 90% of all of everything in Mexico. The peasants have lost all their land. There are stories of peasants who have to, you know, walk over a mile to bury their dead in a cemetery because there's no land in the village that they actually own. The inherited debt that the Reyes, all of this. So obviously this is leading to great discontent. You also have a growing petty bourgeois class which says, we don't actually own, this is Mexico, and we don't actually own anything. So, I mean, the Mexican nationalism in the Mexican Revolution plays a big role in this, and in saying for the petty bourgeois, you know, we want to have ownership over Mexico, over industry, over agriculture, and foreign capital shouldn't. So, you know, that's, I think, is worth talking about, because the United States' relation to the Mexican Revolution at first was a little, well, okay, this might be, you know, this might be all right. Porfirio Diaz was a dictator, and it's a good thing that Mexico has more democracy. But at the same time, they don't want nationalization of the mines. They don't want to lose, you know, all of the foreign capital, which is invested in Mexico. In the days, in the years before 1910, I mean, you've got 5, 10, 25% returns on investing in Mexico. So there, it's really a question here. What's actually going to happen with the question of nationalization? And maybe Victor can talk about it, but there is a discussion. Are we going to nationalize this, and is this going to be retroactive? To talk about U.S.-owned or foreign-owned capital. And they decide they can't make it retroactive. They can't upset the United States.
Right.
And there's an extreme pressure on the president. So they still have to give in to foreign capital. It's still the grip that's you know, over the revolution. And as for the peasantry, I mean, brilliantly led by Zapata and Villa, but they're not comfortable in Mexico City. They're peasant-based. That's, you know, that's where there's a story with Zapata that they're in Mexico City and there was a fire, and there are fire engines, a fire alarm, and fire engines, and it upsets the peasant army. They don't know what's going on. They end up shooting 12 people because they're so, you know, you're coming from rural Mexico. So they're not comfortable in the city, and unfortunately there aren't the alliances made with the working class. They go back to where they're from, in Morelos and elsewhere. And I think it's Lenin who talked about peasant... Someone, tell me if I'm wrong. Peasants as a bag of potatoes, and in the sense that they can be united to fight for something, but they are still independent actors. That is, they're fighting for their own little piece of land, not for collective ownership necessarily. So I think that's a helpful way of looking at it.
What I found striking about the narrative that you told of the Mexican Revolution is that the degree to which the peasantry could be completely independent. But through the Ayala plan, not only did they have political independence, but they actually immediately enacted economic independence. It's hard for me to figure in my mind a sort of industrial or post-industrial analog to that. Because, like, you know, if we took over office buildings and decided that we were going to run them collectively or whatever, that's only one piece of a very large network of economic actors. They can't function on its own. But a peasant community can function largely economically, autonomously.
Thank you. I'm going to call on you next, and after you, I'll bring it back to Victor for a little bit, and I'll continue on to the list.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, that's perfect timing. I have a question. Well, first, just previous comment, like maybe trying to compare and contrast the Mexican Revolution to the Russian Revolution, because they were contemporary with one another. And this is maybe a bit of a hypothesis that perhaps people can clarify or correct if they think this is not quite right. But it seems like while both countries had very small working classes, one of the things about Russia is that you see how the working class is concentrated in cities like Petrograd and Moscow, which are actually quite closely and thoroughly linked with European capitalism, with the Western economies, so that gave that relatively small working class something of a disproportionate leverage or power by being able to take Petrograd, they're able to shake the world. They use John Marino, and I don't know. My sense is that if you look at Mexico City or other large cities in Mexico at the time, they probably didn't have that same relationship, perhaps even with U.S. Capitalism at the time. But that would be a question worth clarifying. And then another side of things, just I'm a teacher in Los Angeles. My name's Randy, by the way. I've been in Los Angeles for 10 years, and obviously Zapata is the revolutionary figure who's most kind of, you know, whose name is on the lips of people on the left and people, you know, especially if you look at the Chicano and the Mexican American kind of left, the nationalist left in LA, you know, everybody's not Zapata. But also as a teacher, many of my students are immigrants from Mexico, and actually their families are from northern Mexico, and they hear stories from their parents and their grandparents about Francisco Villa, and like, you know, they ask about him, and they want to hear a story, you know, they want to know more about him. I'm actually a math teacher, so don't ask me, but they ask my colleagues. They ask my colleagues to teach social studies, you know. So I guess the question now that is, what significant difference is there, political difference, between the legacies of those two? What can we say in terms of, is there a reason that Zapata is considered more important? Is he kind of maybe politically more important? Can we learn more from his kind of wing of that revolutionary struggle than Villa? Or, you know, is it something else? So.
Okay, I'll have Victor go over maybe a couple points.
The float is my own brother's. They're very important in the beginning of the revolution, and I think one of the things I want to talk in my talk about, but there wasn't enough time, was like the difference between the way Zapata and the Magón brothers looked at Madero. You know, the Magón brothers actually broke with Madero before the revolution, longing to actually create an insurrection in Mexico just by going in and attacking some cities and hoping that would start a revolution. And they were actually isolated, and they lost the support of a lot of people in the left, including Eugene V. Debs. He wrote a document saying this is not the right way to do it, you know. And they supported Madero exactly because of the reasons that Zapata supported Madero. This is where the revolution is going to start, and it's the broadest. And yeah, we know this. You know, we know where this person comes from, but I think Zapata was able to deal with it in a way more intelligent way that allowed, you know, his questions of land reform to put forward. The difference between Villa and Zapata and the Plan de Ayala. Villa really did not have a specific plan that would bring people, like the peasants, around his ideas. It was actually something that was, it wasn't his idea, it was something that was brought to him by the people in his army, and they would, you know, they would actually also let people to take over their own land. Just something else I brought up. In Yucatan, where I'm from, the hacendados control all the land. And when I remember one hacendado, like, famously was asked, like, you know, the peasants don't have land. Well, you know, they could plant in a pot. Mm-hmm. You know, that was the sort of, like, attitude I was taking to them and how they fought back. So I don't know if I have... I want to talk a little bit more. On one side, you know, the Zapatistas... we're very limited, and because of the material conditions. But also, I think one of the things to take a note is Zapata's radical roots, and it wasn't only a question of land reform, but it was a question about actually creating a different society that was ruled for themselves in Morelos, that wasn't ruled by, you know, by landowners and everything. And, you know, maybe in my wrap up, I'll talk a little bit about some of the things Marx talked about these sort of what he would call rural communes, that they sort of looked at as the basic unit of the new revolution, that on one side had an actual communal aspect to them, and an aspect of, you know, people working together. It wasn't just, you know, a pre-capitalist society. It held the seeds of a future socialist revolution. But, you know, by its very nature and by its isolation, cannot do that unless there's other forces working on it. And that's where we would point to, you know, the leadership of a working class in Mexico, which I think somebody put it well, was not as politically developed as we would have wanted it to be. But, you know, you can't really blame it. This is one of the first revolutions in Latin America, and they didn't have that many connections with what was going on in Europe. And their connections with, they weren't as strong with what's going on in the United States. Finally, in the United States, I think, invaded the Mexico like two or three times during the revolution, hoping to influence it. So there was that aspect that no matter how much Carranza wanted to work with the United States, he always had to go against them. And there was always that supreme nationalist aspect to it that was codified in the Constitution. In the Constitution, it says that, you know, U.S., or not mostly U.S., but you know, foreigners cannot own a certain amount of a company or cannot own a certain amount of land. It actually nationalized all of the subsoil, which had to do with mining. And, you know, like, all underneath, the land underneath is all Mexican. And most of the ejidos that were created, which were communal lands codified in the Constitution, were owned by the state and allowed for the peasants to sort of have their own communal lands. That would not have happened if Zapata had not put the plan that he had fought for that, like Villa did. So that, I think, is another legacy of them.
Thank you. Did you have your hand up?
No.
Lee? Oh, okay. Go ahead, Nick.
I'm Nick. I live in the neighborhood. Did any countries refuse to sell weapons to Mexico because of the way the revolution was anti-capitalist, maybe because they lost businesses? And did the church have any relationship to the revolution?
Mm-hmm. Good questions. Let me see. And the person with the hat in the corner, is you? No?
Funny.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Hi, I'm Joe, and I live in San Francisco. And, yeah, I wonder if you could make a comment, Victor, on Cárdenas, Lázaro Cárdenas, in terms of, you know, do you see him as a constitutionalist, or a, you know, he did actually bring about some of the... some of the goals that Zapata had in his plan, and but where do you put him in terms of the Mexican Revolution?
Hi, Lance from Chicago. I think it's great to have this talk and to get the history out here, because I think that the Mexican Revolution is like one of the great revolutions of all time that almost nobody much knows much about. And it's actually, I forget the number, but there was like something like 1/10 of the population was killed in the Mexican Revolution. It was like a huge revolution, right? And it's interesting because not only, you could see how the United States would have a kind of interest in marginalizing that, but I was in my favorite place to visit in Mexico City, the Museum of Foreign Inventions. It's a great museum that tells you about how Mexico is fought against imperialist invasion. Then it gets to the last room, and there's a picture of Villa, I think it is, on the wall. And there's like one room about the Mexican Revolution. Well, what are they actually trying to say? Is that the history that museum presents Mexico versus the outside, but doesn't want to talk about the internal class relationships inside Mexico. And that's actually what we did this, the understanding that revolution and its dynamics really are important for us to claim. I think, just to go a little bit farther on the issue of the Russian Revolution and the Mexican Revolution comparison, is that in some ways they're similar in that you have a small working class, huge peasantry in both countries. I think it's true what Randy said, that the working class is much more strategically concentrated in Russia than it was in Mexico. And then there's the subjective factor of the fact that there was a long tradition building through decades of a socialist party, the Bolshevik party, that actually, at the time of the revolution, was able to argue for and win the working class and the peasantry to unite and to overthrow capitalism, but quite clearly with the peasantry kind of following the working class lead. And that obviously didn't happen in Mexico, and that's one of the reasons why the revolutions ended up in two different ways. And then I think that the other thing, too, about the Morelos commune, that's interesting, too. Another thing that's interesting about Zapata is because not only, I mean, yes, you know, he's a peasant leader, and there's all the things that are the limitations about that, but he was actually very visionary, I guess, and politically, in the way that he saw things. He was influenced by a lot of different factors. But for the period of time in which the Zapatistas ran Morelos, they did things like nationalize the steel mills. They had free public education. They tried to bring in scientific advice to the peasants, land the peasants, so on and so forth. Things that maybe later on got codified in the Mexican Constitution, but were never really put into effect in the same way that the Zapata did. And so I think that's another reason why Zapata is so much, you know, why people talk about Zapata more than they talk about Villa.
Okay.
Yes,
go ahead and
comment.
And let me just say, as you were speaking, please, you know, if you have any more questions or want to comment, you can go ahead and raise your hand as you're speaking, and I'll go ahead and call.
Yeah. What about the role of women in the revolution? You've seen some of these photos of women standing in front of a train, with ammunition across their breasts, and are they, to what extent are those photos real? I mean, were women involved as soldiers?
Hey, some questions out there.
I have a question. Yes. You said Zapata was the south and Villa was the north. Can you name a couple of cities or which includes the south, dividing the both north and south, that he fought with of Mexico?
What cities they took over and stuff?
Or that he was actually from, for the peasantry.
I mean, the major city Zapata took over, like the first city that, you know, sort of sealed his leadership was Cuautla, Morelos. And, you know, Villa's base is mostly in Durango and Chihuahua. And he's well known for taking control of Ciudad Juarez. And there's actually a Pedro Infante song about that. It's called Siete Leguas. I don't know if people have heard that. and, you know, taking Zacatecas and you know, all the towns pretty much going all the way to Mexico City. In essence, I mean, they both took Mexico City, so just really quickly.
Okay. Have an open list. Oh, please.
Commentary, sorry. Yes. Jose from San Diego. The 90s, we saw what, you know, I got to see on TV, the people in Chiapas called themselves the Zapatistas, and Santa Marcos, they just had it with being ignored and being abused. And I couldn't help but think about, you mentioned what the peasants were doing, comparing and contrasting that in my head. And they didn't march onto Mexico City and they had no interest in that, but they certainly captured the world attention on that. You know, that's inspiring to me and a warning to that government that's still in power right now. You know, they could get bigger if things keep going worse and worse with the economies right now. Because I know it's going to affect, definitely, you know, there as well.
As for the role of the church, certainly it plays a big role. But I mean, part of the reforms of the revolution are bourgeois reforms, that there's a separation between church and state, that, you know, people could list other ones. And part of the revolutionary movement was to seize church land and take power away from the church. And that didn't go over too well. And the church put up a big fight. And I forget who came after Carranza.
Obregón.
Uh-huh.
He was killed there.
Yeah, and so the church put up a huge fight against that, and they were not successful. So the church was able to maintain a lot of power Maybe Victor can talk more about where the basis of that comes from. So they were not completely successful in the separation between the church and state.
What are the effects of the Plan Ayala on the Mexican left today?
I mean, I could come back. I don't know what the effects of the Plan de Ayala are. Sorry about that one. The role of the church, and this actually has to go... when you look at the church in Mexico, you have to look at like the whole history of the church. And you have to look at different sections of the church. In order to keep control over their colonies, Spain actually was very intelligent in pitting different sections of the society and their colonies against each other. And you know, the growing merchant class was being pitted against these. There was a reason why they gave all these deeds to peasant villages, and that's on a way to keep in check the growth of the merchant class. The other way you keep in check the growth of the merchant class, that which was going to threaten you, was through using the church against them. And the church was a land-hungry elite group of people. After the revolution, the church sided with the royalists in trying to bring a conservative government after the independence. And there was a huge sentiment among various sections of the merchant classes, the landowners and all of that, that there has to be a separation of church and state. And that was the importance of people like Benito Juarez in the middle of the 1800s. And, even the Porfirio Diaz regime was a regime that separated church and state. More towards the end, they didn't. But from what I understand, it's like most of the major segments of the people involved in the Mexican Revolution had some form of more secular way of looking at society, because they were either from a merchant class or, they were the only sort of more religious aspect actually came from the Zapatistas themselves, but that was more of a spiritual thing. They didn't like the church either taking their land. The church actually comes back after the revolution to reassert its influence in what was known as the Cristero Rebellion, and rally the peasant masses against the new government, which they saw as as a secular government against their interests. And just a little tidbit, they actually had the assassination of Obregón. They had him assassinated by a Cristero agent, but that was a failed revolution. But yeah, again, I mean, while not having complete control like they used to before, the church is still a huge institution in Mexico. But like she said, it's it was codified in the constitution. There is the separation, and they're not going to have the same control they always had.
Something about women? Can you say something about women in the revolution?
Oh, yeah. It's a huge role women had. And like with many revolutions that are from below, like take for example the role that women are taking in Iran, they had a huge role. There were the brigades known as las Adelitas in the north of Mexico that had some, like I remember seeing a picture once of like them about to take over like Nogales. And they had a role. Not many times it started in the traditional peasant roles where they would, because what would happen is entire families would go. It wasn't just the men that would go, like entire families would load up on trains and go. And the role of women became central in that. And not only in making the revolution happen, but also in being some of its best fighters. So those pictures are wholly real, and I'm sure there's a lot of those type of pictures all over the Mexican Revolution. In fact, not the main leaders, but there were like very famous women revolutionaries throughout the revolution that led brigades and stuff like that. I think one of them was called La China, and I don't remember if it was this anecdote about, but it was some group of people, and I think she led a train. Like, they would use trains the way to get back and forth. She would lead a train of revolutionaries that had, like, somebody's head at the... it was a crazy time, but they played a major and central role, so...
Would anybody like to take a stab on the question of the effects of the Plan Ayala on Mexico today?
I'm sorry, I'm speaking too tight. I live in Oaxaca right now.
Yay.
And tomorrow is the elections. July 5th is the election. So, Plan de Ayala, I would say, is not a big effect. There is, in Oaxaca, there is communal land. What a lot of people are doing is selling it because they need the money. But land's very cheap there. But, I mean, what are the central questions right now is narco-trafficking. There's a new party in Mexico. It's called the Green Party, Partido Verde. They're for the death penalty, which is a huge debate in the left. They pose themselves as a Green Party, ecologically friendly, but this is a huge ideological problem. They're for the death penalty, so there are debates on that. AMLO's party, of López Obrador, which won the 2006 presidential elections, the PRD, has kicked AMLO out. López Obrador now is running with Convergencia, so there's been kind of a fracturing of the left. Meanwhile, PAN, which is the ruling party in Mexico, is under all sorts of ideological problems because, if people know, there was the what's the word in English? Child care center in Hermosillo, which over 48 children were killed because it kept passing all these inspections when it wasn't an emergency exit, the doors were too small, it had a flammable roof. And so June 5th, a month ago, 48 children were killed. And so there's been this huge ideological crisis for PAN because they've been in charge of EAMS, of the Social Security government, what's the word, government group that has been running this guerrilla. Meanwhile, PRI is the ruling party, which came out of the Mexican Revolution, which ruled Mexico for 70 years, is trying to reinvent itself to get back into power. So there's a fracturing of the left. Plan de Ayala, I don't think, is a part of it, but Mexico has a lot of work to do.
Is Apo still involved?
Apo? Yes. Yeah, but he's in Congress.
No, Apo.
Apo, as far as Apo, which is the teachers' organization in Oaxaca that helped lead the teacher strike in 2006, they've been pushed out of power by repression, and the Apo leaders, which were arrested for... If people know this, in Oaxaca, the teacher strike, which took over the Zocalo and was a protracted strike for 7 months, came down into defeat. And the assassin of Brad Will, who was an American journalist, was by right-wing vigilantes. They were the guilt was blamed on revolutionaries, on Apple. So three Apple leaders have been arrested for the murder of Brad Will. Two of them were just released a month ago. But as far as Apple and the teacher strike, there's not a lot of activity there. And the Zocalo is under reconstruction. The government has taken over that. So, sorry. Mexico today.
Yes.
I don't know if you're able to do this, but maybe you could bring forward from the revolution to the free... to the pond, which I see as sort of the Reaganomics.
Okay. How much time do we have? Let's see.
10 minutes.
Yeah, 15 minutes. All right, just let it keep going on.
Okay.
I don't know if people have more questions.
I don't know if you can, just a couple more. thank you for the woman up here. I know that voto en blanco is a big strategy. Someone can comment on that. That's, how do you translate that? A blank vote, right? It's kind of like a strategy of part of the left. And also, I guess, I live in Albuquerque, New Mexico, so we do have a lot of... immigrants and Juarez right down the road there, but just the different left-right spectrum of the narco traffic, how they support, how Calderon is using narco trafficking as an excuse to go into certain states that are controlled, I think it was the day of the day, I forgot the name of the state, but using that as a way to prepare himself for the elections and how that's used.
NAFTA made the desperate situation in Mexico from the poor and the working class here even worse, of course. I mentioned this to the ISO in San Diego. we got big multinational corporations, big, how about we have multinational labor, Mexican labor unions speak with the American labor unions and the Canadians, you know, exchange ideas with each other, be in solidarity at all times, and start doing some pushback at least.
Yeah.
From here on out. There's any means.
Okay, well, I'm going to give it back up to Victor.
That actually reminded me of a conference that teachers had, the Trinational, that happened in LA, and that was exactly something that happened. It brought members of Oaxaca, the teachers met with teachers in Canada and met with teachers here, and that actually had some influence in some of the organizing that led to what was going on in LA and some of those fight backs too. So, you know, it's very interesting. One of our members, Sarah Canope, talking about how, you know, wow, they were able to lead a huge strike in Canada. Why can't we do that here in the U.S.? Stuff like that. I think, like, you're right in that. Another thing about the drug war, there's a very good article written by, I think, Justin Akers-Chacon in our SW that talks about the influence of the drug war. It's basically, you know, Bush, our wonderful ex-president Bush, came to my region of Mexico, known as Merida and Yucatan. They walled off 40 square blocks. And, you know, there were riots and everything. It was cool. But he specifically went there to sign in what was then known as Plan Mexico, which is kind of like Plan Colombia.
Plan Merida.
Plan Merida? Well, yeah. I mean, that's probably the name, but it's kind of like, in order to compare to Plan Colombia, it's basically the same thing. Military aid, and used as a cover for the drug war, but, you know, like in Colombia, it's being used to repress Latin, you know, to sort of militarize that country and repress the Latin, you know, any sort of rebellion. Couple of things I wanted to talk about, the importance of radical ideas, and I think, you know, there were two very important people, and I think Lance got into it, like, you know, Zapata, not only, it wasn't only about land reform and keeping that, but about a different view of society. And two of his most important advisors were a guy by the name of Soto y Gama, who was an anarcho-syndicalist with the Casa de Guerra Mundial and joined the revolution. And another guy, Palafox, this is a letter. He actually was talking to this sort of wealthy person from Mexico City, Atenor Sala, about, you know, how land reform will be distributed. And Atenor Sala brought up, it's like, I don't know if Mexico can have land redistribution, because it's like, how are you going to pay for it, you know? And, you know, he responded in the letter, it's like, the revolution advocated by the Ayala Plan simplifies the agrarian problem to three preceding principles without wasting one centavo. Its aim is that tomorrow, when the revolution forms a government, it will not be necessary for anyone, including the proletariat, to pay a single centavo. Money is not needed to return the land which someone took from another with the support of a bad government. Money is not needed to confiscate property from those who, for so many years, have directly or indirectly supported the government in the struggle against advocates of the Ayala Plan. It will only be necessary to pay. You know, he goes on to sort of say that, but, you know, those type of ideas which were, you know, pushing definitely to the left. One last thing, and I think this has to do with the question of Cárdenas. And the pity afterwards. And I think this is one of the things that, you know, we should sort of be taking. And this is, I think, where somebody was saying the importance of independence and self-organization of peasants and the independence and self-organization of the working class, which we are for. What ended up happening is two things happened. The ruling class, or, like, I mean, the landowners were defeated, and, you know, you had a certain petty bourgeois group of people come into power, create this very state-run society where a lot of the money they were being made was through state contracts of corruption and to what was known as Latin American clientelism. And one of the ways they were able to sort of suppress any of the movements was to incorporate them into the state structure. So in other words, a lot, there wasn't independent or working class movements. They were just became part of the state and became bureaucratized and all that. That's actually been a weakness in Mexico, and that's actually been a strength of state control of even the sections fighting, you know, like fighting for different reforms and being in the co-optation. That's why the PRI was able to sort of hold power for 70 years, because they not only were able to co-opt those movements, but they still held the mantle of the revolution. That's not to say that through pressure they weren't able to actually enact some of these things. What the ruling class did as soon as the revolution ended, yeah, we have this constitution, it's great, it guarantees all these things, we're not going to follow it. but it took until, say, the 1940s and stuff for somebody like Lázaro Cárdenas. Lázaro Cárdenas was actually, I think, he was some officer in the Constitutionalist Army under Obregón. He was like 16 or something. but by the 1940s, he was able to be part of a movement that actually got him into power and did some serious land reform. He actually redistributed the heat. It wasn't, you know, the type of land reform that Zapata and all of them would like, but it was enough to sort of, you know, be able to give the things that many peasants wanted. And, you know, that's the legacy started by Zapata. Another thing, and this is very interesting for people who look at Latin American state control, is what's going on in Venezuela, with Chavez sort of, even though he's in the left, being able to try to bring many of these movements into the fold of the state, which gets to the questions of what happened when the state sort of grabs the mantle of revolution and controls everything. And, you know, back to one of the reasons why Zapata is so important, it's, you know, and one of the reasons that I think even through this book goes into, you know, the whole idea that, you know, the ruling class tell us that you have to be this educated and cultured person from the high echelons of society. And Zapata totally broke through that. Yeah, there, you know, and Villa broke through that. You know, we're peasants and, you know, we're gonna fight you back and we're actually going to win and try to create a new society. And Zapata was, you know, the way I put it, it's like we socialists talk about the limitations of peasant struggles, but probably Zapata was one of the examples of the most highly advanced and forward-thinking and looking peasant struggles that have ever existed, and that's why it's such an important thing to talk about.